So, welcome to today's Dhamma Talk on this beautiful morning where the rain is trickling down, filling the water jars of your potential nirvana. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. For those of you who haven't become enlightened, I'm going to talk about enlightenment so you know what it is. For those of you already enlightened, you don't need to listen to this talk, so you can leave now. So for those of you who are not enlightened, this today is the talk about enlightenment, what it is, how it happens, and what you can expect. You know, I like to talk about these things because it goes back to an experience when I was a young, still at school, when I started getting interested in religious things. And so going to a Church of England school, used to ask the chaplain there, he's a priest, said, "Now, what actually is God?" And the priest would say, "It's not this, it's not that, it's ineffable, you can't describe it, you can't grasp it, it's beyond all words." And that didn't sound convincing to me. That's one of the reasons why I never took that further. But then, when I became a Buddhist, I started talking about this nirvana business. So when I saw a monk, I asked, "What's nirvana?" And he said, "Well, it's beyond words, ineffable. You can't grasp it." And straight away I said, "I heard that somewhere before." And so sometimes, what are you struggling to get to nirvana for when you don't know what it's going to be? Are you sure you really want to get there? The Buddha actually gave a lovely simile. And the simile he gave was a bit cheeky, but he said it's like this man who goes around saying he's fallen in love with the most beautiful girl in India. And he's in love with her and wants to be married to her. And his friends say, "Well, where is this most beautiful girl in India? What town does she live in?" "I don't know." "Where's her parents? What's her name?" "Don't know." "Is she tall? Is she short? Is she fat? Is she slender?" "Don't know." And they say, would the talk of such a young man be looked upon as being foolish and crazy? He's fallen in love with someone he doesn't even know. He's never even seen yet. He's never even met yet. It's just on the reputation that somewhere in India there's the most beautiful girl. And that's the one I want. And that's the one I've fallen in love with. And that's like a person who's fallen in love with nirvana. I want to go to nirvana. But where does it live? Is it short, long, fat? What is it like? Well, I don't know. I just fall in love with it, that's all. It's crazy talk. So, for those of you who try to get to nirvana, where are you trying to get to? You're trying to get to like a phantom. Trying to get to something is you don't even know where you're going. And because you don't know where you're going, that's why you keep getting lost. So, instead of aiming for nirvana, which is a place you don't know where it exists. Instead of falling in love with the most beautiful girl in the world, you don't know where she lives or who she is or how to get in contact with her, in the Dhamma, in Buddhism, we just go to peace. Not to pieces, we just go to... We don't go to peace. We go into peace. And we find what's most peaceful, what's most present, what's most at ease. And that becomes a path which we can actually know that this is actually getting somewhere. We meditate not for the sake of nirvana, because you don't know what that is. You're meditating for peace, for wisdom. There's something about the peace and wisdom which you've already experienced so far which means something to you, which is suggestive of like a happy abiding, an insightful abiding, a spiritually fulfilling abiding. And those of you who have even just started meditating, already you get some sort of taste that this is peace, this is stillness, this is going in the right direction. And that's what we go for. And you can say that path leads to nirvana, as I'm going to describe now. But it's a path which leads inwards, never onwards. A path of inner peace, inner opening, of compassion, kindness, love, freedom. All those aspects which one associates with the ultimate. And one can probably understand that as one goes in that path, it just gets ever more full of peace, ever more full of depth, ever more profound, ever more wise. That's why it's called a gradual path to enlightenment, to nirvana. So what is actually happening when we're going on this gradual path inwards? You know, by the way, the direction you're going, you get an insight in where it's going to lead. Already when you start practicing on this path, you get more peaceful. The deeper in meditation you get, the more peaceful it is. And you've experienced that so far. You get into just, you know, watching the beautiful breath. That's pretty peaceful. And some of you got into these nimitta states, which is so still, so peaceful. You can understand you're starting to scratch the surface of nirvana. You can imagine that degree of peace you've already had and take it to its limit. That limit is nirvana. Sometimes the happiness, the joy you feel, the sheer pleasure of peace which you feel when you are practicing in this way, you are feeling so content, so at ease, and that's incredibly joyful. You've already felt some of that already. Imagine that peace, that ease, that fulfillment. So, you know, going to its ultimate level, that's nirvana. Sometimes when you're meditating, you feel so free. Nothing bothering you at all. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to achieve, no sort of demands to meet. There's nothing to do, complete freedom. I like being out of the jail. We have many jails in our life, many sort of different cells, and the cells within cells within cells. And here you're getting out of those cells, you feel just so free. Already in your meditation, many of you have felt a great degree of freedom. If you take that freedom to its extreme, that is nirvana. So it's by going on the journey, you get tastes of freedom, tastes of nirvana. That's actually a simile of the Buddha, nirvana, a taste of freedom. So as one practices through experience, one gets a feeling for what this nirvana is, and it becomes such an attractive, such a pure, such a peaceful, such a lovely thing. Of course it takes you further and deeper in. And what actually happens as you go deeper in, you see these terrible things we call attachments. These like burdens we carry around with us, the balls and chains around our legs, the rucksacks full of rocks on our back, the suitcases in our hand, and all this, what I call the coffin on the top of your head. Imagine you're carrying a coffin on top of your head. That coffin stands for all your past actions and deeds, good ones and bad ones. It's like a dead stuff, the coffin of the past. People carry on their heads, backwards and forwards through their life, never being able to let go of what happened. And so no wonder they get headaches. So here, little by little, we find ourselves letting go of these things. These are called attachments. Sometimes you really wonder, why can't people just let go? Why can't they throw away the coffins of the past? Let the dead bury the dead. That was the saying of Jesus, I think. Throw them all away. Why do we carry all these burdens around with us? Why do we carry these suitcases? Have you started packing your suitcase yet? Have you started thinking about packing it yet? See, it's stupid, isn't it? It's a whole day and a half, at least. Because, you know, some people have suggested we carry on this retreat for another 2 weeks. Who knows what's going to happen? So why do we keep sort of packing our suitcases before necessary? Why do we keep carrying them when we don't need to? Why do we do this? Why do we put so much stuff in your bags when you came here, just in case? And you haven't used it at all. Stupid. So, we do this because it's called attachment and craving and clinging. There's a great simile of clinging, and I always thought this was an original Ajahn Brahm simile, but I'll tell you what happened afterwards when I explain what a simile is. Because as a young monk, I knew that all this attaching business was going the opposite direction to nirvana. You're not supposed to attach to anything. So as soon as you gave up a monk, as soon as you became a monk, you gave up sex. And so, okay, stop it. And he started thinking about sex. So you had to stop that one and give that one up. The next thing, you started to eat a lot. And so stop eating a lot. Then you start thinking of eating. So all these dreams. I remember this one dream I had in my first year of a monk. I was going into this shop. And the shop front was actually made out of chocolate eclair. And the bench inside was made out of like chocolate on the top with cream underneath the bench. It was like a chocolate eclair shop. And everything, the walls, the ceiling, the seats were all chocolate eclair. I used to like chocolate eclair when I was a layman. And that was sort of the dream I had the first year as a monk. So this is what happens, that you give up one thing and you're grasping on something else. And it just became just hopeless. As soon as you let go of one thing, you pick up something else. Have you noticed that? As soon as you let go of the world, you go and pick up jhana and start attaching to that. Or pick up something else. And so I thought, my goodness, what am I doing here? How can you stop picking things up? And then a simile came to me. I thought never heard before, but I'll say again, there's an ending to this which really shocked me. I thought, that's just like having a hand. This is what picks things up. He said, no matter how I try and stop my hand picking things up, I can't, because that's the nature of a hand, to pick things up. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. You can't do that, because that's what a hand does. The nature of a hand is to pick things up. And I realize that's the nature of a mind, a self, a me, is always to attach to things and pick things up. So I thought, the only thing you can do, if I'm going to stop my hand picking things up, there's only one way. That's to cut my hand off and throw it away. And I thought, that's the only way you can stop attaching to things. To cut off the self and throw it away. Because this is just the nature of a self. A self is what does things, what grasps things, what tries to own things. That's the nature of a self. And I thought that was a great simile. And I thought that, wow, I never heard that one before. So you can imagine when I started reading the suttas to see the simile of the hand was said by the Buddha in the Sanyutta Nikaya, almost word for word. Ooh, that made me shiver. Because actually I hadn't read it before. See, sort of a simile of the Buddha, and you thought it out for yourself. So you understand what enlightenment is. It's not grasping things, and it all comes from letting go of this doer. Another simile, I gave this one, and this is not done by the Buddha, and there's a good reason why it's not done by the Buddha, because this is a simile of the driverless bus, and there were no buses in the time of the Buddha. So this is the Nirvishvara Lajjan Brahm. This simile is one of my favorite ones. The driverless bus. It's like your life, your being, is like being in a bus, going on these journeys, this journey of life. And sometimes this bus goes to this beautiful territory, this magnificent scenery of rolling hills and waterfalls, and oceans and lakes and trees and meadows is so delightful. And so you tell the bus driver, please slow down, please stop, this is so wonderful and pleasant, I want to enjoy this to the max. Most of the time the bus driver puts the foot on the accelerator and speeds up. And so the pleasant experiences, they don't seem to last as long as they should. And soon the bus goes through this terrible scenery. These toxic nuclear waste dumps. These old industrial East European estates. These places which are full of graffiti and rubbish. So ugly, so detestable, so unpleasant. So you ask the bus driver, get out of here as quick as possible. Put your feet down on the accelerator. Let's speed out of here. This is terrible what we're experiencing. More often than not, the bus driver puts on the brake. And you have to endure the unpleasantness longer than you think you should. So there's something wrong with this bus driver. So one day you decide to go and, as they say in Australia, to sort the bus driver out. To tell him what he's supposed to do. To instruct him properly. Look, when it's pleasant, slow down, stop. When it's unpleasant, get out of there. But first of all, you've got to find where the bus driver sits. And the whole part and point of the journey is finding the bus driver's seat so you can instruct him about pleasure and pain. Now in that simile again, the bus stands for you. And your little mind there sitting in the seat. Sometimes we experience unpleasant states. Pain, disappointment, disease. And you think, why does it last so long? Why can't I just get out of here as quick as possible? Why do all the difficulties seem to last? But then when you're having a great time, when things are going well, and you say, slow down, enjoy it, I'm having fun. And why does, when you're having fun, the days and nights pass so quickly? Why does it just finish too soon? Why is it that you rush out of the wonderful, pleasant states of mind too quickly? The will, that's a problem. A will just doesn't get it right. The bus driver. So you've got to find out who this will is to sort it out. So you don't make so many stupid mistakes anymore. You don't make such bad karma anymore. You do the right thing. Sort out the will. How many times have I told you, you sit down here, you just let go. Just watch the breath. And how many times you've thought about fantasies, thought about the future, worry, control, and all these things. I'm stupid, you tell yourself. Come on, will, get yourself together. But you have to find where that will lives. And the whole point of this meditation, or one of its major points, is to find the bus driver's seat. Find the seat of your will. Find where you come from. Your inner seat. The heart of the doer. So just like back in the bus, you walk up and down, see where this bus driver sits. And finally you find his little cabin. You open the door of the cabin, it's called Janus. And you go inside. And you see the bus driver, so you can tell him off. And you get the shock of your existence. Not of your life, your shock of your many lives. Because you find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. When you get in the door of Jhana, where the will is, you open that door and you go in, you find there's no will left. It's an empty seat. Now that has profound consequences for your journey. When you know there's no bus driver, well, nothing else to do. You just go back in your seat, sit down and shut up. No point complaining anymore. No one's driving this bus. Who can you shout at? You might as well shout at the mountain. Nice experiences. Let go. That's all right. Make peace. No one to shout at anymore. Beautiful experience. Okay, you let go. Make peace. No one to shout at. No one to control anymore. The empty bus driver's seat. And that's a great simile for what happens in your meditation. You will get your shock of your many lives when you go into these deep states of meditation. And you find there is actually no one in control. All this time you thought you were in command of your life. That you were the captain, the general, the commander-in-chief of me. And now you find there's no one there. Imagine what happens. When there's no control, no commander, nothing to do anymore. So, you let go. Now, seeing the empty seat, the bus driver's seat being completely vacant, seeing the emptiness of you is called the attainment of stream winning. Becoming a soul one in Sintalese, seeing there's nobody in here, that has consequences. First of all, people say, uh-oh, if that's what enlightenment is, I don't want anything of it. I want to be in charge. And here's Ajahn Brahm trying to kill me. I'm not trying to kill you. You can't kill you. There's no one in there to kill. I'm just trying to wake you up to see that you don't exist. You're just an illusion, a fantasy, which you have of me. So when you've seen through that fantasy, seen through that illusion, of course, there's nothing much to do anymore. All of your striving and struggling starts to end. Joy at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. You don't have to do anything anymore. You don't have to strive for anything anymore. Great, you can really let go. Sit in your seat and just enjoy the journey. No complaining, no worrying, no stress, no craving. Because when there's nobody in here, how can you pick up anything? How can you be attached to anything? The hand has been severed. That's the attainment of stream meaning. Seeing that emptiness has its consequences. The consequences are you stop picking things up. And the momentum of that bus slows and slows and slows until it finally comes to a complete halt. Life stops as we know it, Dr. McCoy. That's right, isn't it, Bones? You told me the other day from Star Trek. Life, but not as we know it. You stop. Now this fourth stopping is called full enlightenment. This is actually where you become the arahat, the ending of this process. Now to understand it in another way, like more and more peace, more and more freedom, more and more happiness. Understanding it this other way was one of the Buddha's great similes for the stages of enlightenment. Because I've only just mentioned the stream winning and the four arahats. Those are the two main attainments on the path. It's first of all when you see the cause of all your struggling and striving. And once you see the cause, obviously that cause is finished. You just have to wait for the momentum of the bus just to slow down and stop. Most take 7 lifetimes, according to the Buddha, for you to completely come to a stop once you see the driverless bus. Because what actually happens is this. It's the Buddha's simile of the 7 shipwrecked sailors. It's a great simile to explain what enlightenment is, simply because it puts it into a metaphor which everyone can relate to. You can actually see it. Obviously a metaphor from the time of the Buddha, because they didn't have buses in the time of the Buddha, but they certainly had ships. And every now and again the ships would meet a storm, and the ship would go down, and many sailors would actually be in the ocean there, struggling for their lives. There's many Jataka tales about shipwrecked sailors, but in this particular one is the story of the 7 shipwrecked sailors. The first shipwrecked sailor jumps into the water from the ship and goes straight down. Done. Dead. The second shipwrecked sailor goes up and goes down, goes up and goes down eventually. Bobbing up and down, but eventually tiring out, going down. The third shipwrecked sailor is the one who actually floats on the surface and knows how to swim so that they don't go down. That's shipwrecked sailor number 3. The fourth shipwrecked sailor, having floated to on the surface, being able to sort of tread water, looks around and they see dry land over there. So the fourth shipwrecked sailor floating on the surface is one who sees the dry land. The fifth shipwrecked sailor, they floated on the surface, they've seen the dry land, now they're swimming towards it. The fifth shipwrecked sailor is the shipwrecked sailor who's on the way to the shore. The sixth shipwrecked sailor, they've already swum so far, they're so close to the beach, they don't need to swim anymore. They're standing up in the surf, wading to dry land. They're that close. And the seventh shipwrecked sailor is the one who's made it to the shore and is sitting under the coconut tree having a nice cup of tea and a piece of toast. I always change the description of what they're doing at the end to fit the modern times. But the point is, they're safe, they're relaxed, they're having a good time. That's the seventh shipwrecked sailor. They're safe. And in that simile told by the Buddha, the first shipwrecked sailor is the scallywag. Those who've been very naughty, who haven't kept their precepts, who've been selfish and cruel and stingy, when you hit the water, you go straight down. The second shipwrecked sailor is the one who's done a bit of good karma, a bit of bad karma, a bit of good karma, a bit of bad karma. They bob up and down, but eventually they go down after a while. The third shipwrecked sailor is the one who's done good karma, like the good person. They've been kind, they've been generous, always giving donations, keeping the precepts, being compassionate, doing service, always saying nice things about others. They're the good person. So they float on the surface. You don't go down. You never get submerged in the troubles of life. The suffering, the ups and downs in life, little waves on the surface, you manage to keep your head above water, to keep afloat. Your good karma is keeping you afloat. Now, keeping afloat, and it's important to have that good karma, you cannot be the next shipwrecked sailor, the fourth, which is the stream winner, without having good karma, staying afloat. Because the fourth shipwrecked sailor looks around and sees dry land, that's the stream winner who sees Nibbana, who sees the end of all this suffering, who sees the end of all this grasping and all this worry and fear and struggle. You see Nibbana. Because you're floating, you can look, ah, there it is over there. So the fourth shipwrecked sailor is the one who's seen Nibbana, seen non-self. They're on. The next shipwreck sailor, number five, swimming, is the one that on the way to Nirvana, on the way to safety. They call that the once returner. It's the second stage of enlightenment. You're on the way. Interestingly, they never actually say just how far on the way you are to qualify as a once returner. But it doesn't matter. It's just you're on your way. That's good enough. And eventually you swam so far that you're not just within sight of dry land, but you're standing up in the surf, you're wading, you're that close. And of course there's no way you can sink anymore, because there's solid ground underneath you, even though you're still a little in the water. That is the anagami, the non-returner, who's so close it makes little difference. And the last one, who's sitting on the dry land having a cup of tea, some toast, and reading the morning newspaper, whatever it is. That's the arahat, completely free, safe, secure, no need to strive anymore, having a good time. So that's the Buddha's similes. I'll accept the newspaper, the toast, and the tea. That was my part of it. That was the Buddha's simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors. So you can understand what this journey towards enlightenment is. But the most important, crucial part is actually seeing the shore, seeing Nibbana, seeing the emptiness of the self. Now, it needs to be said, though, many people have all these amazing theories for what Nibbana is. And when I first came to Perth, when Ajahn Jagra was the abbot, when we stayed in this little house in North Perth, this young man came to see us and he said, "Yeah, we believe in Nibbana as well." And Ajahn Jagra said, "That's really interesting. So what's your idea of Nibbana?" He said, "Oh, Nibbana is a little planet which is just beyond Uranus in our solar system. And when you actually practice our way, you get reborn in the planet Nibbana." There's a lot of crazy ideas of what Nibbana is. And that was one of the craziest of them. But there's all sorts of ones in between. Now the point is, and this is a fascinating point, in the time of the Buddha, every even villager would know what that word meant. Because it was a word in common usage. It was applied to other things. In particular, it was a word used when a flame went out. This morning when I doused those candles, if you were living in the time of the Buddha, you had said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm Nibbana the candle." That was the word which they used for the flame of a lamp going out. And that was used by the Buddha in this beautiful simile of Nibbana to this wanderer Vajragotā. The simile of the flame going out. He said, "What is a flame anyway? A flame is just a condition which relies on three sources. If it's, say, a candle flame, It depends upon the wax in the candle. It depends upon the wick. And it also depends upon the heat. When those three conditions come together, you have the flame. But if any one of those conditions is removed, if any one of those causes is taken away, such as the wax is all used up, there's no wax left, the flame goes out. Or if the wick is all burnt up, again, there may be some wax left, but without the wick, there's no flame. The flame goes out. Or if the wind blows away the heat, like I did this morning with my hand, make a wind so it blows the heat away. Then again, the wick may be there, the wax may be there, but the flame goes out. So the wick depends upon those three causes: the wax, the wick, and the heat. And if any one of those things is taken away, the flame goes out. When we say it goes out, the Buddha said, does the flame go to the east, or to the west, or to the south, or to the north? Or does the flame go to some planet just beyond Uranus? Does the flame go to this wonderful place where all old flames hang out in peace and happiness forever and ever and ever? Is there like a final abiding, a cosmic abiding for the original flame? Now, it doesn't make any sense, does it, to say things like that? The flame just goes out. The causes which put it into conditions, made it arise, are no longer there. So there's no flame anymore. That's all we say. And this is how the Buddha described you when you nibbana. All the five causes, not the three causes, the five khandhas, the body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, all those things which have to come together to make a you, to make a me. When one of those things is taken away, the whole thing falls apart. Where does the self go when that all falls apart? It's just like saying, where does the flame go after it's doused? It doesn't go to the east, the west, the north, or the south, or anywhere. It just nibbanas. Now, do you understand what nibbana means? Even people in the time of the Buddha, even little children, would understand what it means. Whether they thought it was possible or not, understood it completely, at least they would have known its implications. So it all depends upon this wonderful thing about seeing there's nobody in here. So there's nothing to lose. A lot of you get very afraid when we talk about nibbana, saying, I'm going to die. I'm going to disappear. I don't want to go. I've worked so hard to get enlightened. I've strived for so many lifetimes. Now do you mean I can't be there to enjoy it once it happens? That's true. Now, one of the stories about enlightenment is when I was about 7 years, I think, as a monk. Just before, the year before I came to Australia to help out over here, I was already very fluent in Thai. And my meditation was going very well. At that particular time, Ajahn Chah, the great teacher, was still alive. And even though he was alive, by that time his sickness had begun. Just after I came here, his sickness really took off, and he went into a coma and never spoke again for about 9 or 10 years, and then he died. So I was actually there for the last 9 years or so of his teaching career. And on this particular occasion, because he was getting quite sick, the monks at Not Wat Nana Chah, which is a monastery very close by to Ajahn Chah's main temple, to explain what happened, Ajahn Chah's main temple is called Wat Bapong. That's the one he set up close to his village. That's the one where he spent nearly all of his time and of his life. But when he started getting Western disciples, Ajahn Chah was just incredibly smart and wise. He thought, yeah, it's great to be able to teach these monks meditation and teach them Dharma and even get them enlightened, but what next? And he realized that one day those monks would have to go off to the West and start their own monasteries. Not Thai monasteries, not sending like a Thai monk out there, so that each monk could go back to their own culture and teach from their own culture. You know, one of the problems, those of you who come from the ethnic communities, you can see that Sri Lankan monks might come over to the West, but they very rarely do they ever really relate to the local culture. And you used to get Sri Lankan monks, Sri Lankan people come there, nobody else. Thai monks set up their temple, Thai monks go there, no one else goes there. Burmese monks the same. And never really actually get into the culture. So Ajahn Chah realized, look, the best thing to do, if you're going to send Buddhism to England, send English monks to England. So let's train them, first of all. First of all, just train them into the practice so they can get stages of enlightenment. But number two, let's teach them how to teach. So he sent the monks off to this little monastery about 6 kilometers distance from his monastery, within walking distance, and said, here you go, here's a monastery, you run it. So we had to learn from experience, hard experience, how to run a monastery. It's one thing being a monk, it's one thing being a meditator. Being able to run your own monastery is something quite different. But the point was, Ajahn Chah was only just a short distance away, so when things went wrong, which they often did, he would come in and sort it all out. So this is actually where we train to be trainers. It's like a teacher training college. And that was great. So, we were all in this monastery, and of course, you'd like your teacher to be there as often as possible. So he was so busy in this other monastery, even though it was only 6 kilometers away, he'd hardly ever come. So he thought, what can we do to get him to come here? So we knew he was sick. And one of the monks had this brilliant idea, let's build a sauna for him. Because in the old traditions, actually, you were allowed to have saunas in your monastery. They had them in the time of the Buddha. And so we thought, great, it's traditional. And once we get a sauna, maybe it might help our teacher's health. Maybe it might not. Who cares? At least we get him to the monastery once a week. So we built this sauna for him. And it worked. It was a great plan, very successful. It meant every week our teacher would come for his sauna. And I'm honest, there's no other saunas anywhere else in hundreds of miles. So we had the only sauna there, and so we invited our teacher there. So it was great to have your teacher around, do the services, but also he'd always give a Dharma talk for you. So every week we'd get a Dharma talk for certain by Ajahn Chah. So it was a brilliant investment. And so he used to come every week. And I remember this one occasion, like sometimes that the monks, they just really hit the spot. Sometimes you don't, sometimes you listen to even a great teacher like Ajahn Chah and it's boring. But sometimes they just, don't know what happens, they just hit the spot and wow, it's just amazing. You really get inspired. So after he finished, I was just really high, having a wonderful inspiration from the Dharma talk. And then it was time to do the duties and go and help him with his sauna. But there's so many other monks there. And I thought, well, I always do lots of duties for my teacher. Why don't I just go around the back of the hall and sit quietly? So I let him go off with somebody else. And at the same time, while he went off with other people, I went to the back of the hall and just had a really nice meditation. You know, when you're inspired, it's easier to meditate. So I don't know how long it took, but when I came out, I was just so peaceful and so blissful. The first thought which came up was, I've had my nice bit of fun. Maybe I should go and see my teacher now, see if Ajahn Chah needs any help. So I got up and walked in the direction of the sauna. However, I was too late. Because Ajahn Chah had finished his sauna, he was actually coming in the opposite direction. We crossed paths. He was with two Thai laymen. He was going back to his car to go back to his monastery. But this was one of those occasions where you get these great teachers and they gaze at you and you feel them looking right through you, using his great powers, because he saw that I'd had a good meditation. He checked me out. And then he looked me straight in the eye. And said, "Don't answer. Why?" Just like that. "Don't answer. Why?" He was asking me the deepest question of all. Why? And I looked at him. I looked at my heart. And I said, "I don't know." I was still a young and stupid monk. He was trying to enlighten me. He was trying to just get me to use my samadhi to see the deepest question, the cause of all things, why? And all I said was, "I don't know." And so he laughed. like, you know, he usually does. The seriousness all disappeared and he just broke out into a laugh. Great teachers never criticize you. They never punish you. Whenever you make a fool of yourself, they think it's just so funny. And he just laughed. And then he pulled his face together again and went serious again. He said, "Bumawang, sir, I'm going to tell you the answer to that question. If anyone ever asks you that question again, this is the answer." And so Ajahn Chah, this great monk, told me the answer to the question why. When these great monks say those answers, they are very, very deep, very profound, capable of enlightening you. And do you want to know what the answer was? Why? The answer to that question is Mai Mi Arai. That's Thai. What it means is there's nothing. That was the answer to the question why. There is nothing. He looked me really deeply again and said, "Bao Wang, sir, do you understand?" I said, "Yes, yes, yes." I said, "No, no, no." I said, "No, you don't." And then he strode off laughing. And when I tell that story, I ask, "Do you understand?" "No, you don't." There was a great little dialogue there between the two of us. The dialogue between the last enlightened master and his stupid disciple. But you always remember that. The answer to the question why, there is nothing. Now you understand about anatta and how the whole thing unravels once you start to see that. And once it unravels, you know exactly what's going on. You just allow the unraveling to carry on. It's hard to see that there's nothing unless you've got into such a state of emptiness as a jhana. Because you always think there is something there, there's something substantial, that I am, that will is, that this all is, and all these thoughts are important, and doing, having fun is great. But when you get into the deep states of meditation, just change. Not only is it bliss, but many things have vanished there. You've seen many things have gone to nothingness, to emptiness. Enough for you to understand that what's left may also go to emptiness, be insubstantial, be without a core. It's enough to give you that insight. Once that insight is there, because the hand has been cut off, you stop picking things up anymore. You stop controlling. You stop attaching. You might have relations and friends, loved ones, people you care about, but they're not yours anymore. These are just beings who come into your life, who one day will pass out of your life again. You know that's a fact. What's the big deal? Why do we attach to people? Why do we say that this is my son or my daughter or my husband, my wife, my parents? They're not your parents. You don't own them. Did you buy them in a shop or something and you've got a little certificate to say you own these people? These people belong to nature. They don't belong to you. Even your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to nature. When nature says it's going to be sick, you'll make it sick. When nature says it's time to die, you will die. You may go kicking and screaming, saying, "I don't want to die. I'm too young to die. I'm only 90. That actually happened. Somebody wrote about this in the book. And I think it was a 92-year-old lady. She went to the hospital. She was healthy all her life. And they diagnosed her with cancer. And she came out saying, "Why me? Why me? Why me?" 92, for goodness sake. You've done a good job. And say, "Why me?" You should expect something by 92. But anyway, sometimes you think, "Oh, I'm too young today." It doesn't belong to you, your life. So why not let it go? What doesn't belong to you, give away. Do I belong to you? Does this redemptorist monastery belong to you? In a day and a half time, you clean up your room and you leave all this behind. And you won't worry about this monastery anymore, because it's not yours. Why can't you walk away from your body when you die? Not mine. If you can do that, when you know how to let go, You can enjoy the company of your friends and loved ones, of your fellow travelers on the path. You can have fun and joy, and you can laugh at the jokes. You can cry at the sad times. But when it's all over, you walk away without any remainder, carrying nothing from the past, completely letting go, being totally free, with nothing to bind you down anymore. It's like a bird which flies off into the air. It hasn't got a place to land. You've got no place to attach to, no place to grasp anymore. You're free like a bird, homeless, without any belongings, without any baggage, free to fly off into the sunset of Nibbana. And there they go, riding off into the sunset. What a wonderful end to the great romance novel of enlightenment. And so this is what happens, this is what enlightenment's all about. It's a natural ending of things, a pacifying, a calming. And if you think, oh, I don't really want that, it's already, as I said yesterday, too late. As soon as you get a taste of enlightenment, a taste of letting go, a taste of freedom, you're hooked. It's even more addictive than heroin. There's one taste and you're an addict for life. Each one of you are now meditation junkies. You may not come to the next retreat, you may put it off for a while, but I guarantee you'll be back here again. That little taste of freedom, that little beauty of emptiness, the most wonderful experience of your life, even though you may not taste it fully, just a whiff of it, is enough to say, wow, this is pure, this is what has real meaning. It's a bit scary, yeah, but can't force it. Reason, experience, all supports this. It's just the ones a bit reluctant. The stronger one sends the self, the more one suffers. As the self gets weaker and weaker, gets happier and happier, as you completely disappear and merge into nothingness. So this is what Nibbana is. The last thing to say about Nibbana, perhaps the most encouraging thing, is that the Buddha always said, Nibbanaṃ paramaṃ sukhaṃ. Nibbana is the ultimate happiness. So, if you want to be happy, this is the path. And for many people, and I'm one of those people, that this is what motivates you. Happiness. I became a monk, not for the sake of finding out some ultimate truth, but because of the deep meditations I had as a layperson. They're just so powerful, so happy, I wanted more. And while you go deeper and deeper, pulled by the law of ultimate happiness, you get truth as a side dish. As you go to deeper and deeper happinesses, more and more profound and beautiful serenities, you're actually walking on the path to Nibbana. So those of you who want to be happy, who want to be blissed out, who want to get the ultimate bliss, you'll find yourself being drawn into the jhanas, drawn into the letting goes, drawn into the insights, drawn into the stages of enlightenment. It's a natural process. And as you get less and less, as you start to disappear, your happiness gets more and more. The less of you there is, the more bliss. It's as if you stand in the way of bliss. And as you disappear, bliss, ecstasy, has got more chance to establish itself in you. And so when you disappear completely, all that's left is bliss. Nibbana, the ultimate happiness. That's what Nibbana is. So I hope I've done a good marketing job today, so they say, yeah, we want it. So there's the talk today on Nibbana. Anyone got any questions about today's talk? They're all very good. Yes, go on.
In the days of Buddha, it seemed to be more common that people would be enlightened. There's 500 people at one stage just getting together.
Yeah, they say in those days that people would hear talks like this and everyone listening to the talk would get enlightened. People are just so stubborn these days. They don't follow instructions. And I think you can imagine that the cream of the crop would always take birth in the time of a Buddha. If you had a choice of being born in the time of Ajahn Chah or Ajahn this or Ajahn that, or being born in the time of the Buddha, yeah, go for the Buddha, go for the boss. But the point is, it's still possible, it still happens these days. It's still there for you now. So listen carefully. See if you can follow those instructions. I think one of the reasons is, and I make this a big point in my talks, that the necessity of jhanas, when jhanas isn't taught, it isn't encouraged, people don't have the experiential data to see what I'm talking about. They think, oh yeah, that's just a monk. He should sort of, you know, get a proper life, get a job like the rest of us. He's afraid of relationships. He should go and get married and find out what real life is all about. And all that sort of stuff. So because if you haven't understood an experience of the jhanas, even have a little bit of experience of jhanas, you want to understand what makes a monk tick. The final little puzzle about nibbana is right there for you. In jhanas, an emptiness with a bliss where you don't exist, but there's a beautiful energy. So if you want to get enlightened, shut up, sit down, be quiet, get jhana. Yeah, 7 lifetimes. Yeah, that's only for the slow coaches. The reason is that once that happens, once you see the non-self become a stream winner, sometimes it just depends upon just how attached one was beforehand. Just the past karma. Sometimes, even though you know the shore is there, you swim just so slowly because you miss your ship. You miss all your friends. And you look back and say, oh, do I really want to go? Do I have to go? But do I really want to? And you just, you know, mess around. But the point is, you have to go to that shore. There's no other place to land. And it's a fascinating point here that once, and this is, I upset people this way, but I can't refuse to tell how it is. Once you see that where that dry land is, once you see non-self, there's no turning back anymore. You can't decide, no, I'm not going to become enlightened. I'm going to stick around to help all other beings. There's no way of doing that anymore. You're pulled. There's no choice anymore. There's no self to make that choice anymore. You're out of here. And you can't stop. You can linger most 7 lifetimes. But that's the max. Yeah. Good on her. Yeah. We just explained to your friend who's seen that blue light on a couple of occasions and she's associated that with death. Well, that's actually quite true. It's almost certainly she's recording her previous death experience Because as I mentioned, this is what happens when you die. The five senses in the body are let go of. You have to let go of them because they just can't persist any longer. They're dead. In the same way that nimitta appears when the five senses disappear in your meditation, this is the nimitta appearing at this time of death. Which is obviously a really, a reasonably good person, a kind, pure person. She's a beautiful blue light. And that's probably almost certainly what she saw at the time of her last death. And she's associating that with death, which is correct. It also needs to be mentioned that the older you get, the closer you get to death. Now your five sense faculties get weaker and weaker and weaker. Because, you know, you're dying. It's a process, not just an event, unless you get shot or a heart attack or something. So the five senses get weaker and weaker and weaker. And if you've lived a really good life, your mind pure, 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 that nimitta gets more accessible just when you're about to die. Because the five senses aren't so strong. They don't interfere so much. So that nimitta will come up to her when she's close to death. But to understand, all it is a reflection of her beautiful mind. To tell her that. If she's seeing a beautiful nimitta, that's her she's seeing, her mind. And so she's no need to be afraid. And when that happens, just let go into that nimitta. Don't control it, don't do anything. Just really relax and allow yourself to merge. Sure, you will die, but you'll have a wonderful time. You live long enough. It's a time for people to let go when they've lived long enough. The last thing you need to do is to struggle when this poor old body wants to go. So let it go. Leave it alone. It's not mine anyway, so you can just abandon. Just relax and enjoy. So it's true. What she's seeing is an imitator, reflection of her mind. And it's beautiful, so she'd be very happy. If she saw this really black, dirty, ugly little sort of light coming up into her mind, then she should be a bit afraid. But if it's a beautiful blue light, good. Yeah.
In meditation process, why nimitta is so important that you have come to before the jhana?
Can you skip the nimittas? People always want the shortcuts. But what happens if you take the shortcut, you usually get lost. And it is possible to get into a jhana without a nimitta, but it's not to be recommended, simply because you may go too quickly, you don't know the path in, you don't know the path out, and you've gone so fast, you don't see the gradual letting go, which is necessary for understanding the ways into jhanas. The nimitta is powerful. So what it does is it actually shows a reflection of the mind before you merge into it. You've got that little moment of seeing this beautiful thing called the mind, and learning how to watch it and let go. And secondly, that if you go into a jhana through the nimitta, it certainly is a jhana. You've experienced those nimittas, really bright, becomes so still, incredibly blissful, and you just go straight into it, or it emerges around you, then you know that it's a jhana. You know it by the path in. Other times, and people might get some experiences, and they think it's a jhana, but rarely is it a real jhana, and it hasn't been through the nimitta. Sometimes I think it might be, but most times not. So it's a good signpost. You've got into the right place, and you're not wasting your time. So that's why I really recommend developing the nimittas. Just a sign the mind is strong. Let alone it sort of helps you when you die, because you know exactly what happens. When you die, I said, here we go again. I know this one. Ajahn Brahm's told me about it. And so there you go. You've got all the instructions on how to die. Very rare you can get those instructions. Not many places. They can tell you how to sort of what to do when you sort of turn on the microwave. They can tell you how to sort of assemble your DVD player. But it's not many places. You can get instructions on how to die. So at the very least, what you've got here is a lesson on how to die. Soon you'll have the exam. Any other questions before we finish off? Yeah? If you decide, it will never happen. It has to be choiceless. And obviously, I should have mentioned, when you have become a streamer, an arahat, because there's no, you see the emptiness of the will, there's no choice, there's no doing anymore. That's why the arahats have there's nothing between them and the jhanas, you just go straight in. Anagama is again, there's nothing there at all, just go straight in. You can let go, because there's nothing there. Stream winners again, very easy, because there's nothing there. Emptiness. All this non-doing business, what I'm teaching you, it's almost like training you to be a stream winner. And the more you control, the more you go in the wrong direction. So it becomes easy. You just let go. Allow the world to be the world. Yeah, someone around the back? Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't know how it can be. It doesn't make sense. You can only delay it before you become a stream winner. And then you're unenlightened and stupid anyway, so you can't help anybody. And the point is that once one becomes enlightened, it's like simile of the doctor. A doctor spends 8, 9, 10 years training, especially if you specialize. And those years, especially our last years as a doctor, you take away all of the best physicians, all the best surgeons, all the best doctors who are training you, when they could be there helping people. So you're a parasite in those years on the medical profession, taking, never giving, just going for your own degree, that's all. But we allow that to happen. Obviously it's a great thing to happen, because eventually those doctors graduate and they become practitioners and then they can serve. And this is exactly what happens with Buddhism. You become enlightened, you graduate, and then you serve. If you serve before you graduate, that's a pretty dangerous thing. I know if I have an operation, I want to have a graduate, a doctor, no medical student cutting me up. So who would you want sort of teaching you? An arahat or someone unenlightened? Who would you want? Obviously the enlightened beings can do far, far more. Teach not only by words but by example as well. So teaching by example. Teach other people to become enlightened. If you haven't done it yourself, you're a hypocrite. So the way of the Buddha became enlightened first. Buddha became an arahat, and then he taught for 45 years. And those 45 years of teaching of a Buddha are still reverberating today. One Buddha teaching has huge effect. Doesn't need to stick around anymore. 45 years of teaching, 2,500, 600 years of history, and the power of that teaching hasn't diminished at all yet. So you don't need to keep on teaching. You set the Dharma wheel in motion. And as it says in the first sermon of the Buddha, once the Buddha set that Dharma in motion at the deer park in Benares, he said, now this wheel cannot be stopped by anyone in this world. Once it started, it's unstoppable. He doesn't need to keep pushing it. Started it. The snowball is falling down. It won't stop. That's why his teachings are still here today. Monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, just like you, follow these teachings, become enlightened, teach for a little while, make another enlightened person, and then you go. As long as everyone makes one more, there's always plenty to go around. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Let's now have the interviews. Enough talk. Go and find your bus driver's seat. Go and sort that guy or that girl out. Go and kick butt. Not convincing, is it? I try to be. Sort of like tough guys at home, but I just haven't got it. Okay. So now the interviews in the room next door. And as on the list, please keep to the list.